My name is Bob Miller, and I'm a very grateful member of Al-Anon. A member of the Middle Ground group in Savannah, and it's the best group in Savannah. And I really believe that. Alright? When I was asked to speak this afternoon, I knew he didn't have time to prepare anything, so I just turned it over to my higher power, and he's going to make a talk, and I hope it's a good one, because I have no idea what he's going to say. They didn't tell me what I was going to talk about, so I guess I'll talk about me. I'm the son of an alcoholic and father of an alcoholic, two of them, matter of fact, and husband of an alcoholic. I've got a couple uncles that died of alcoholism, and it runs in our family. It runs in my mother's side of the family and my father's side of the family. And it's not done running yet. I can see some grandkids coming. And one in particular. And you can tell. This little boy is 4 years old. And I'll tell you, if he's not going to be an alcoholic. Huh? Anyway, I get started with my story because I got a long story. It went on for a long time for me. I had never heard of Alcoholics Anonymous, and we've never heard of Al-Anon, and there was no one in my family that had ever made it to recovery. So it was quite late by the time I got here. My earliest recollections was, well, I was a very small child, and it was before I was 6 years old. And I remember real strongly because it was always like that. It wasn't any different. I'd lay up in bed, and I'd be laying up there, and I could hear the screaming going downstairs, and I could hear the fighting all the time, and I could hear even when my father wasn't home, I could hear the preparation for the fight, because I could hear my older sister and my older brother telling my mother, asking my mother to just please leave him alone, just please don't say nothing to him. And you always knew when she'd get up ahead of steam, and she always knew, she was going to meet him at the door. And her mouth was hooked to the doorknob, and as soon as that turned, they went nose to nose. And we knew that all we wanted to do was get in and go to bed. And we also knew he didn't have a chance of doing that unless he hit her. It was the only way he could get her out of the door. And that was the only time he did hit her. But that came up quite frequently. And my mother and I, when I was 4 and 5 years old, my mother was a very religious woman, and she had a real strong God consciousness, and she tried to pass that along to the children. And we would make an altar up, and we would get flowers out of the front. We had violets and stuff growing along the house. And we would get these little flowers, and we'd put up statues, and we would start praying that Dad was going to quit drinking and that everything was going to be all right. And we would kneel down there, and I was a real skinny little kid, and that really hurt to kneel on them hardwood floors, and I remember how much I hated Dad. And after a couple weeks of that, I started hiding on her because I knew it wasn't working. But as an adult, adults have an ability to live in denial for generations and decades. Or even as a little child, you can see when something's not working, you know, and you quit. By the time I was 6 years old and started to school, and I don't remember starting to school. I don't ever remember going to school. My life was so filled with anxiety, and I had what doctors describe as post-traumatic stress syndrome, and that's where you just relive the nightmares over and over again, and I had nightmares every night by the time I was six. And I don't have any recollection of anything except the terrible stuff. Now, I'm sure there was a lot of good stuff in the home, but I don't remember it. I remember when I went to school, and I don't remember going to school the first day or anything, but it was a parochial school, and we went to church for an hour first, and then we went to religious class for an hour. We did that every day. And I'm sure they didn't mean to, but what they did was they taught me to hate God. My mother had always taught me that God was a kind and loving and God and benevolent, and someday he was going to help us. Someday he was going to pull it out for us, and someday it was going to be okay. And of course, I wanted to believe that. And then when I started my religious training, it went the other way. I was told that God kept records. And every time you done anything, you was committing a sin. And they had a huge list of venial sins, what they call venial sins. And for all these venial sins, if you committed any of these sins, you would be forgiven for them and you would not go to hell, but you would go to purgatory for a couple weeks or a month. Nobody ever said how long you're going to have to spend in purgatory, but you'd definitely have to go. And we were studying for my first Holy Communion, which you do in when you're first grade. And then we got on to the mortal sins. And the mortal sins, and everybody knows what most of those are. Honor thy father and thy mother, and thou shalt not steal, and all those things. And by the time I was 6 years old, I knew that I could never live up to those standards, and that I was going to commit mortal sins. I knew that. And I knew that this God, whoever he was going to punish me the first chance he got. And he was keeping track every day. And I was rolling up a lot of time in purgatory. A lot of time. And when I didn't do my homework, it was a sin. It wasn't just a bad boy, it was a sin, because it was sloth. And if I ate too much and I got sick and I threw up or anything like that, or if I didn't eat enough, I was harming the temple of the Lord. And that was a sin. And that was gluttony. And there was a sin for everything. And I committed all those sins on a daily basis. And so I remember being told that up until the time you go to First Holy Communion, you're not accountable for these sins because you haven't reached the age of reason. And if you haven't reached the age of reason, all will be forgiven. And you'll go to heaven if you die. Now, mind you, I was brought up as I was a very disturbed child already at this young age. I had a very distorted view of reality. And naturally, what I did was I figured out in my little mind that if I ever wanted to go to heaven, I had to die somehow before First Communion. It was my only chance. I found some shoelaces out the garage and I tied them around my neck, and there was an old chair out there, and I tied them up on a rafter, and I kicked that chair out from underneath me, and I tried to hang myself. My first suicide attempt, 6 years old. And I hung there just for a couple of seconds, and shoelaces broke and I fell down, and that big red mark around my neck. And I went in the house and my mother asked me what that red mark was, and I told some of the other kids had done it, you know. I didn't try to do that again because it really felt strange hanging there for one thing, and it hurt. And I figured I'd take my chances on down the line, you know. And we grew up on the outside of society, like most children do that are grown up with in this kind of environment, because by the time you were 6 or 7 years old, you were living pretty much outside. Even though I had great fears about being outside, because I was consumed with fear. I was consumed with fear for my mother, I was consumed with fear with myself, and I was consumed with fear of everything, of God, of animals, of dogs, of cats. But that fear of staying in the house and fear of what might happen in there if a newspaper got rustled at the wrong time or somebody made a sound. And you never knew when it was going to explode. But you knew it happened a lot and you knew you didn't want to be there. So by the time you were 6 or 7 years old, you never went in there again. The only time you went in was to go to bed or to eat, and that was it. And this is the way I was raised. Naturally, when you're living like this and you're that kind of person, you're not going to be the most popular kid in school. And so you you kind of live on the outskirts. You know, you're not the real in-group of kids. So you kind of just shift over to the other kids who are like yourself. And you travel on the outskirts. And that's where I was. I was with a black leather jacket and racing cars and DAs and that kind of stuff. Neat stuff. The rest of the kids were studying and doing homework and, you know. And I thought, what a terrible life those kids have. They have to go home at night. They have to be home on the weekends. They have to do homework. Yeah, you know, I didn't have to do any of those things. I wouldn't go home for 2 months, and I'd walk in the door, and Mom would say, "Are you hungry?" That's all she ever said. She was totally obsessed with my father. My father was totally obsessed with the booze. And that's just the way it always was. By the time I was... By the time I was even in my teens, I was still doing this, going to church every morning and still having my religious instructions for an hour. And I really hated God. And I would go to church every morning and I would kneel there and I would curse God. And that's what I did. I would kneel there and I would call him dirty names and I would tell him that he was no good, rotten SOB, and if I ever got a chance, I was going to spit in his face. And I thought that he was punishing me for these sins, all these sins that I had committed. I really thought that he was punishing me for those, and that he was never going to get off my back. And I just hated it. This never got any better. When it got time for me to get out of high school, I did continue to go to school. At the age of 12, I was going to kill my father, and I took the shotgun to bed with me, and we didn't have any shells in the house, and it was one of those nights again, and I asked my mother the next day to please buy me some shells, because I knew that somebody had to do it. Somebody had to put a stop to it. And I knew I was going to hell anyway, so it wouldn't make any difference. I was a likely choice to do that, because there was no chance for me other than to go to hell. I was certain of that. And she told me again that how much Father loved us and how she loved him. And they both loved us. If it wasn't for the liquor, everything would be okay. And I told her that I didn't believe that anymore, and that she could stay and put up with that stuff if she wanted to, but I was leaving. And I went out and I walked down a country road until I found a job on a farm about 2 miles out of town, and it was found out later, a friend of my grandfather's. And I stayed there, and I worked there for $1 a day in room and board. And when I got a little older, I lived out to canning factory. We had a tomato canning factory in town, and you'd hire on there for the summer, and you'd live in school buses out there when the tomatoes were coming in. And that's pretty much how my teenage years went. By the time I was 17, I wanted out of town, and I wanted out of the family, I wanted out of the state, and I just wanted out. The only thing I wanted out of this life was out. And I was scared to death that this God was going to send me to hell and eternal damnation, and I couldn't kill myself, because I thought that was the rottenest thing he'd ever done. It was after he made life totally unbearable. Then he made a rule that if you ever kill yourself, you'll go straight to hell. So it left you no way out. There was no way out. So, with my own distorted thinking, which I always had, I thought, well, I will go in the Marine Corps and I will be able to die honorably in there. And everybody had either went to the Second World War, or my uncles and my older brother went to Korea. And I thought, well, I'll go in the Marine Corps and I will die someplace, somehow. I will find an honorable way to die and just get out of this. And I went in the Marine Corps. And it was really neat for me. It was really neat because I wanted out of that town and I wanted to out of that religion. Is what I really wanted out of it. And I thought, once I get out of here, I'll never have to do that again. I'll never have to go to there again. And I didn't. I got to boot camp and they called out first Sunday to go to church. I didn't show up. I never quit going when I was a kid because I couldn't stand to hurt my mother. My mother always, I thought, was hurt enough. I couldn't stand to see her hurt. And my mother and I always had something real special. And I never wanted to do anything to hurt my mother. And I finished school for her, and I kept going to church for her, and I'd done those things for her. Of course, when she couldn't see me anymore, I didn't do them anymore. And I got off to boot camp, and I thought, boy, this is really neat. You know, you had three meals a day, and you had lived inside, and it was a nice building, you know, and you had people take care of you, and they cared about whether you was there or not. And I thought, boy, this is a neat place. I really love it here. And everybody else was bitching and moaning about a terrible place and rotten food. You know, I thought it was really great. And the Marine Corps did something for me. Because coming to where I come from, I didn't want to live. I always hated myself, and I hated what I was, and I hated who I was. And that was the first place I went where they told me what to do, and they didn't ask me what I thought. They didn't ask me how I felt. They just told me what I should do and when I should do it, and how I should act and how I should look and how I should behave. And they told me these things. And that worked a lot, because anything different than what I was doing would have worked. And it did work, and it worked for me. After I was in 6 months, I went overseas, and I was suffering from this terrible guilt of leaving my mother and my sisters in that situation, and I always really hated myself for that. I always hated myself for not putting a stop to that, and I somehow thought it would have been up to me to do that. And I was still on a daily thing of feeling terrible guilty about not going to church and how terrible this God was going to punish me when he finally got me, whenever that was. And I drank a lot when I went overseas. Matter of fact, I drank every day, you know. In the first 6 months I was there, I was drunk every day. And then I discovered girls. Because booze didn't fix me. As a child, I wanted to grow up and be an alcoholic. That was my dream in my late teenage. I thought, I'll just buy some wine and I'll sit around and I'll lay around in the streets and people come by and I'll hold out my tin cup and they'll throw coins in it and they'll all say, look at him, and they'll say, oh, that poor kid, and he had his whole life ahead of him. You know, and the tears would run down my cheeks, and I would just think about that for hours, you know, in self-pity. And I really loved that. That was a good feeling for me. But the booze didn't work. My mind was running at such tremendous pace all the time. And it would start out from the second I woke up in the morning. And my eyes would open, and my mind would start on it. You know, you're too tired. You can't get up. Your knees sore, they're going to make you march today, and you're not going to be able to do it. You know, you're sick to your stomach. It would just start on me the second I got up. You know, I tried to kill that with booze, and it didn't work. The more I drank, it didn't make it to have no effect on me. I just felt just like I did. I'd drink and drink and drink for hours, and I felt just like I did before I started. Some people say that's an alcoholic. For me, it was dreadful. It was really a terrible thing, because I thought I could stop it somehow. I thought I could stop my mind and I could get a little peace, and it didn't work. But I discovered girls, and the girls were rather expensive. These were not dates. And, it cut down on my drinking considerably. And I thought, well, this is really neat, you know. And I was feeling better about myself all the time, because I was getting love. I had people that really loved me, you know. The fact that I had to pay them didn't make any difference. They really loved me, and they said it, and they treated me nice. And I had never been treated like that before, and that was neat. And so I thought, well, maybe I can make it after all. And I get back to the States, I went on liberty the first week I was back to the States. I said, well, I'm gonna find me a wife, and I'm going to have some kids, and I'm going to have a family, and I need to get me another girl real quick. And I knew I couldn't afford them over here. So we was out with three other guys, and we followed this group of girls, and they went to this little eating place and a little fast food place, and we followed them in. And they come piling out of the car, and we all picked ours out. And, you know, everybody said, oh, I'll take this and I'll take that one, you know. So I picked mine out. And I said, this girl I'm going to marry. You know, and take her home. And that's it. Because, you know, it looked to me like she had a lot of friends, and she was happy, and she was joking, you know. And it looked to me like she was happy anyway. And I thought, well, if I have somebody like that, I'll be okay. I won't have to do dingleberry. Just all of a sudden, I'll be okay if I get this person. And so I followed her home that night, and I asked her for a date. And I didn't know that she was a child of an alcoholic also. And I was totally crazy, but she was a ACA too, and so she couldn't notice. She didn't notice I was totally crazy. You know what I mean? I didn't notice it. She was totally crazy. So, I wrote my mother a letter that two days later, and I told my mother I met a girl that I'm going to marry. And I just picked one out. You know, to me, coming from my background, it didn't make any difference which one. I figured, you know, most women were nuts anyway, you know. I had a grandmother that used to be holed up in a little room with a little thing overhead and burning candles and incense, and you know, and I knew she was nuts. And every time we went out there, she said, Bobby, come give me a hug. This will be the last time you'll probably ever see me. I'm going to die, you know, and you'll never see me again. And you couldn't even see her. She was in this dark little room all the time. And then with the way my mother was, I knew she was nuts. And my sisters were all nuts. I knew that. My older sister ran off with a drunk when she was 17. You know, she was living with an alcoholic. And I could see she was nuts. You know. So I figured it was all like that. That's just women. That's just the way they are. I can live with that. You know, everybody else got one like that. It's no big deal. We had a good time together. I didn't make a lot of money, and she didn't require a lot of money. The 97 cents for a bottle of wine was gun price in that day, and sometimes cheaper. I'd go in the liquor store before I'd pick her up, and whatever was in the old wicker basket out by the front door with the dust all over it, that's what we had. Yeah, whatever that was. And she enjoyed that. We just got on the beach. We didn't have to go to fancy restaurants or anything like the rest of the girls went to go to movies, you know, and do things like that, go to amusement parks. We went places that were cheap and we drank, you know. Unfortunately, she got pregnant. And her mother had always told her that if you ever get pregnant, you'll shame the whole family. You do anything you want, but don't you ever do that to us. Because you know what people will think. And she was pregnant. And it was my fault. Whenever anything bad happened, it's my fault. And I was used to that, because everything was always my fault anyway. So, you know, I accepted that. And she hated me. And we really hated each other. But in those days, it was a real big thing to do the right thing. It didn't matter what it was. If it was the right thing to do, that's what you'd do. So we got married. We went to a justice of the peace and we got married because it was the right thing to do. And right after the wedding, she says, I hate your guts. And I says, I hate your guts too. And she said, well, I have this damn kid and then I'm going to leave you. And I said, okay. You know. I didn't really feel that way, but I knew she did. She really felt that way. We told her mother about it, about getting married, and her mother told her to pack her stuff and get the hell out. She brought shame on the whole family, and for 45 minutes while my wife was packing, my mother-in-law set me out there and told me how miserable this person was going to make my life. What a rotten, no good kid this had always been, and how she had always destroyed their lives, and how she was going to destroy my life. Mother-in-law wasn't far from wrong. We were still in the service at that time. And a real strange thing started to happen. because they have a lot of parties and stuff in the service. And I used to tell her, I'd used to call home and I'd say, we're invited to a party tonight. And when I'd get home, she'd be too drunk to go. I thought, gee, that's strange, you know. And then we'd go to the party, and I'd kind of drag her and half scoot her over there. And then she'd spill everything, and she'd always be hanging around with the guys, you know, and she'd always be dropping drinks on the floor. And it really pissed me off, because I went to party to get drunk and have a good time, and I'd take care of her. Yeah. And someplace around there is where my Al-Anonism started, whatever that is. I became the caretaker. It was my responsibility to get us home. It was my responsibility to get her in bed. It was my responsibility to take care of the kid. All those things fell on me. And I figured, well, it's not going to last that long anyway. It's no big deal. But we really tried. You know, down deep there someplace, and after we had that baby, you know, it was such a cute little baby, and we thought, well, you know, we'll really try, because there was something there once when we was gone together, and we really did like each other. And we really did try. We tried for about 6 years, you know. We had expectations on each other. She expected that I was going to make her happy, and I expected that she was going to be this wife that I always wanted, and she was going to have make me happy. And I'd done everything that she wanted me to. We started out because it was my family. And she was my wife. And that was my kid. And we were going to be okay. But you see, we were never okay. But I tried to make it okay. And I thought, well, if she's okay, I'll be okay. And if we're okay, the kid will be okay. So she said after we was married 2 years, she said, well, maybe I can stay with you. Maybe I can love you if you go off to work like my father did. My father, her father was an engineer, and he always went off to work in a white shirt. And she told me at the time that she really hated her father and that he was so boring. And all he did was come home and go to sleep. And she didn't want a life like that. See, and she was looking for an outlaw. And I looked like an outlaw. And I acted like an outlaw. And that's exactly what she wanted. She wanted out of society. I looked at her and I said, isn't that a sweet girl with all those friends and that nice house and everything? And I wanted in society. You know? But because we were both brought up in alcoholic homes, we knew that you could never tell the other person how you really felt or what you really thought or what you really wanted. Because if they ever knew who you really were, they wouldn't love you anymore. And somehow you just know that. You can't never let anybody see who you really are because they won't love you anymore. So we never talked about any of these things. After about 6 years of being married, though, it wasn't working out too good, and she wasn't making it. She started having a lot of physical ailments and started to drink a little bit more. And she told me that she was going to leave me. She told me she didn't love me anymore, and she was going to go back home. And you see, she was my wife. She had no rights, and she wasn't going to go anywhere. And I told her that I loved her enough for both of us. And if she left, I'd track her down, no matter where she went, and shoot her in the head. And that I could make it all right if she'd just give me a chance. And naturally, all during this time, we was moving around, geographic cures. We started out in one state, and we moved out of that state because it was too cold. And we moved to a place where it was a little bit warmer, but it was in a little steel town, and it was too dirty. And we lived there for 6 months, and the neighbors had a dog that barked. She couldn't stand there, she couldn't sleep. So we moved to Kansas. Kansas was okay, but then the summer was too hot, and she didn't like the neighbors, and the air conditioner didn't work right, so we moved to Toledo, because Toledo, you didn't need the air conditioner. And then we lived in Toledo for 6 weeks, and she found out that the person who lived in that house before had died in that house, and it gave her the willies, so she said she wasn't going to live in that house anymore, so she left. She called her father to come and get her. And her father come and get her, came and got her and took her home. And they told me, you can come if you want to, but we'd rather you wouldn't. You know? And that wasn't enough to stop me. You couldn't get rid of me that easy. And I had loaded everything up in a U-Haul truck, and I followed them home. You see, I told you before, my mother-in-law was an alcoholic. And when my wife and my mother-in-law, who had never had a relationship, when they got together this time and she was grown up, they had a relationship. And every day when I come home from work, there'd be an empty gallon of wine there, and the second one they were just starting on, it'd be about 5 o'clock. What a relationship they were having, you know? And then my stepfather died, and my wife got pneumonia, and she couldn't drink, and she was sick in bed. She started going through the DTs, and she started seeing snakes, and she started doing a lot of stuff. And so I called the doctor out, and the doctor come out. And he said, I know just what you need. You're just like your mother. And he gave her a shot of Valium. And that started the trip. So you go to sleep, I would shoot myself in the head. And she started backing out on me again. Just like a crawdad, always going backwards. Right? And I told her, you know, come on, let's do it, let's get over it. Well, the kids will find us here. I said, the kids will be all right. They'll grow up anyway. Doesn't make any difference if they find us here or not. And we argued for about 45 minutes on whether he's going to do it or not. And finally she says, I'm not going to do it. I said, oh, shit, then I got to get back to work. Put my work clothes on, went back to work. Before I left, I cocked my pistol and I laid it on a little nightstand and I said, you still feel like this in a little bit. So, don't call anymore. I'm sick of this. The next couple years I spent, the only time I talked to her, I tried to talk her into doing the right thing. I tried to talk her into killing herself. She would say, I just can't make it anymore. I can't make it another day. And I would say, I don't know why you'd even want to make it another day. You're the most pitiful thing I've ever seen. And if I was anything like you, I wouldn't want to make it another day either. Finally, she called suicide hotline. And they took her to a treatment center. They come out and got her. And they called me and they said, we've got your wife in Country View out here. And I said, I'm not paying. Because, see, I've always been, that's all they ever did was send me bills. I didn't know where she was and I didn't care. But I always got the bills. So that was always my first response. I don't care what you do with her, but I'm not paying. And they said, well, we're going to keep her in here for 28 days. I said, you can keep her as long as you want, but I'm not paying anything. You can gouge your insurance for whatever you think you can get. But you don't come for me for nothing, because you're not getting it. After 20 days, they called me and they said, she's not going to make it. She's not coming out of it. And we're going to have to send her to the state funding farm. And I said, well, that's where she belongs, and that's good. I don't want her back anyway. And they said, well, maybe we can keep her another week. If you can keep her another week, another year, I don't give a shit. Just keep her. Yeah. But she was in there, and on that fifth week, she come around, and she got a sponsor, and she come out, and they started taking her AA meetings every day. And I went to, they told me about Al-Anon at the treatment center, and I went to Al-Anon, because I knew that those people needed help. I had 33 years living with an alcoholic, and I thought, my God, I'll be able to do something for these people. I don't know how to do that stuff. Yeah. I went into this little dingy room, and it was in the furnace room, and you know, like the Al-Anon rooms used to always be. We had one little 60-watt bulb hanging over the little card table, you know, three other people in there. And the A's were down the hall, and they had this big room, and they had coffee pots and toasters. You could hear them laughing and joking down there, you know. And I was still wet and sweaty from having walked 7 blocks, because that's as close as I'd parked my new truck to the AA members. I never went to a meeting with my wife because I thought, I know how sick those suckers are. And one of them's going to run off with her and I'm going to be done with her. Yeah? And that was the only reason I really ever let her go. Because I thought, she's going to run off with one of them. And he's going to get the bills, and not me. And I really hated her. And she really hated me. At least we thought it was hate. We didn't know what it was, but we knew it wasn't very pleasant, whatever it was. And it hadn't been pleasant for a long time. And I didn't care about her anymore. And I went to my first Al-Anon meeting. And they gave me a lot of hope at that first Al-Anon meeting, and they told me that they couldn't make my alcoholic quit drinking. And I said, I don't care. And they said, and we can't save your marriage. And I says, if you're going to save my marriage, I'm not coming back. And they said, but you'll feel a lot better. You can learn here how to feel a lot better than what you feel now, and you won't ever have to feel that way again. And I said, well, I'll come back on one condition. If you don't talk about God anymore. I really hate God. He makes me sick to my stomach. And they said, well, we won't talk about your God then. We'll just talk about ours. You know, and that was the first time I realized that there was more than one. You know? I always had this monster, and they had a nice guy, you know? And it started out like that. And I didn't understand any of the language. You know, and they started out with the first step, and they said, you're powerless. And I said, I'm not powerless. I've got this assault rifle, 3 automatic handguns, baseball bats, and I'll be damned if I'm powerless. Well, they went on to unmanageable. They said, your life's unmanageable. And I had no idea what that was. I came for 2 years before I had any idea what that was. I had no idea. And finally I heard an AA member said, your life's unmanageable if it's not what you want it to be. And I knew it sure wasn't that. It sure wasn't what I wanted it to be. And with all the language things I had a problem. And in my second meeting they talked about detachment, you know? And they said, well, you gotta detach from it. And I was picking this up. Just like that, this stuff, because I really wanted it. And I walked in the house that night, and she said, did you have a nice meeting? And I said, get off my back, bitch. Yeah. I detached the only way I knew how. That was it. This guy that said a lot of neat stuff first meeting I was there, got to be my sponsor. And we went through a lot of stuff together. We went through a lot of stuff. And one of the first things, I'd come in there and I'd cry and I'd bitch every week, you know, and I'd say how these terrible people were hurting me, and I'd already thrown my son out, and now I had a daughter and she was starting, and she was high every day. And he told me to go in a room by myself for an hour, and pay attention to how I felt, and then come back and tell them. And so I did that, and I went home, and in between there and the next meeting, I'd sat home for a couple hours by myself with the door shut. And he said, well, how'd it feel while you was in there? How'd you feel? And I said, well, I felt terrible, miserable. He said, was there anybody in there with you? And I said, no, nobody. He says, well, I guess you know who's doing it to you then, don't you? And that was the only first real progress. That's when I started really paying attention. And that little doorknob that was my higher power over there really started working, you know? I almost started to give it a name, because it had always been the doorknob, and then it was a group. You know, we worked through the literature, and we worked through all that. And I told them that I'll work the steps with you. I'll do 1, 4, 8, 9, and 10, because they don't have God in them. And that's the only ones I'll ever do. And he says, but you won't get well. I said, I don't need to get all the way well. I just need to get feeling a little bit better, and I'll be okay. I did that for 3 years. I finally worked step two in the course of those first 3 years. Only the fact that I admitted that maybe everything wasn't okay with me, you know, just maybe. And step three, we got down to that, and he said, well, all you have to do is make a decision. And I said, well, I'm not going to do that, you know. And I went to a convention, and I heard the speaker say how he got rid of his God. And he had this vengeful God, and you know, he had a similar background to me. And he said, and I took everything I ever knew and everything I ever heard about God, and I put it in this big chalk statue, and I blew it up on a windy day, and it just all blew away, and I could start up with a brand new God. And I created the God that I wanted, that I thought God should be. And I thought, that's really neat. I can do that. And mentally and intellectually, I did that. And I got rid of that old vengeful God. And I started having a God in my own understanding. And this was after quite a while in the program. And I talked about that a lot in meetings. And people started saying to me, I didn't hear that. I didn't hear him say that. It was a year after that when I finally got that guy's tape and I played it back. And none of that stuff was on that tape. Nothing. But I heard it. But I was there. And it was really... I was about 3 years in the program, and I still hadn't done some of the steps. And I started going to ACA. Everybody said you have to, you know, you should go to Adult Children of Alcoholics. And I went to Adult Children of Alcoholics. I went to Al-Anon Adult Children of Alcoholics one night a week, and I went to California-based ACA group once a week. We'd go in for 2 hours every Sunday afternoon and read what was wrong with us, and then we'd read how we were going to fix that. We'd cuss and cry and kick chairs and light candles and burn incense and do all that stuff. And real neat stuff, because I really wanted to know why I lived like that and why I'd done all those things and why I was so miserable. And through those two experiences in Al-Anon ACA, which is basically all step one, I knew then why I'd done all that and why I'd been like that. It didn't do me any good to know that. But every time I went to a meeting and they said, Bob, you really look depressed. And I'd say, well, I really am. They'd say, what's wrong? And because of all my ACA experience, I could tell them, well, I'm depressed because those people didn't treat me right, you know. And I'm depressed because I had a miserable childhood and I don't know how to live. And I'm depressed because my role models never taught me anything. You know, I knew why then that I was like that. But it didn't do me any good. Until finally my sponsor says, I guess if you want to go any further, you'll have to do the God steps, huh? And so I started working on the God steps, and I finally went, step five had God in it, and I had to go do step five, and then I had to do six and seven, and six and seven were really neat. As soon as I learned how to work six and seven, my life really began to change. It really started to make a difference. My daughter, by the way, I'd only been in about 3 months, and my daughter, I got to say this, but she was coming home late every night, and I was still on guard duty, and I was going to quit Al-Anon after a couple months, and I was going to one meeting a week, and somebody had to guard her, and the wife wasn't doing it. She was still gone to all her meetings and stuff, and so I talked about it at the meeting, and they said, well, you have to detach from her. And so I said, okay, well, I can do that. I'll just detach from her, like I did with the wife. Hell with it. Yeah? She was 13 years old. And I went home that night, and I said, from now on, I'm going to detach from you. You go do whatever you want. Let your conscience be your guide, and I don't care, and don't tell me about it. Next night, I went to a meeting. I come home at 10 o'clock. She wasn't there. I waited up to 12 o'clock. She wasn't there. 1 o'clock, I called the police. And I went down to the police station. We had all the police cars. We was out searching all over town for her. 1:30, she showed up. Oh. I said, where the hell have you been? She said, why are you asking me that? You said I could do whatever I wanted to. You said you was detaching from me. You see, that was another one of those things where I got it mixed up just a little bit. And you got to be real careful what you knew with this language thing, because it can really lead you astray unless you talk it over with somebody about what you're really going to do. And anyway, we got through all that. And a wife and I never worked on our relationship. Never. Because we had no communications. We never established any communications. We didn't want any communications. And all we wanted was out. But as we both got better, and we started to treat each other better, and we set up a line of communications in our meetings with the other people. I had a line of communications with Al-Anon people. She had a line of communications with AA people. And out of that grew the ability to talk to each other. And we have a good relationship today. We have a... Matter of fact, I got a brand new wife. This person is nothing like the person that I've ever known. She's a brand new person. Not that she's 100% well, but she's the best her she's ever been. And we're still together. And we still go to a lot of meetings. And it's been a really neat trip. And we really love y'all for making it, for being here for us. Because we still need a lot of meetings. We still go to a lot of places. I've learned a lot of really neat stuff about how